Accession number 32297, reel 27.
John Dixon, reel 27. So when you were at Ford, where were you accommodated on the airfield?
In a hangar? No, we had our own hangar, of course. But as I said before, the aircraft were shared between the two squadrons, and the ground crew were shared, and the regular staff were all shared. So we just turned up for the weekends and used whatever was there. There were officers' quarters there if you needed them, but as you can see, I used to go down mainly on a Sunday at the crack of dawn, have breakfast in the wardroom, and then start flying. But when I was going for the full weekend, by then I got a small son. So generally speaking, my wife came down with me, and we stayed in a pub in Littlehampton with the baby in his carry cot, and so they had a weekend there. And my observer, he similarly, you know, with a just wife and child. So we lived off the base, and just went in for flying.
How did you get down there?
Car. Yeah, we were lucky enough to have a car in those days.
So was it a difficult commitment with obviously your working life and your family life? Was it easy to fit everything around it? I mean, you know, you mentioned obviously about the work element going on the Sundays, but is it quite a commitment to make?
Yes, it was, and one or two people couldn't or didn't keep it up. I mean, they sort of tended to disappear. Our CO, whose name was Bovey, Commander Crash Bovey. Well, he became a commander when we formed two squadrons. He was very hot, you know. I mean, we were going to be the top dogs, and he wasn't going to have any backsliding. So if you couldn't keep up the commitment, there was somebody else who would, sort of thing. So we were kept pretty well up to scratch. Looking back on it, I worked in a private firm of surveyors, and they didn't give me any condensations for allowing me to do this. And when it came to my fortnight's annual training, that was my holiday. Now, had I worked for a bigger organisation or a government body or something, obviously they would have had to let me go. But being a small firm, we couldn't really afford that sort of manpower, so I just had to forego normal holidays just to keep up with the flying, which was a bit hard on wife and family, but we had a good social side to our commitment, so that wasn't so bad.
And with the sort of 2 week commitments, were they always in the UK, or did you...
Now that's an interesting point, isn't it? I don't remember what we did in 51. I think we were still working up, so we probably just stayed around Ford and got thoroughly acclimatised with what we were doing with the fireflies we had then. But in 1952, we went back to sea. and we flew out at the crack of dawn all the way up the English Channel to somewhere off the Belgian coast, to HMS Triumph, which was another light fleet aircraft carrier, not dissimilar from my old ship Vengeance. But I can remember flying up there in formation, and I was thinking to myself, it's 6 years since I've flown on and off an aircraft carrier. I'm a married man with a house and a mortgage and a small child. What am I doing this for, you see? Was it for the sense of duty or for the sense of love of flying or what? I can't... I wish I could give you a straight answer. But I think we were so proud of our skill and commitment that this is what we did. And we just... A lot of the lads, mind you, were bachelors, so it was a different story for them, perhaps. But quite a few of us were married, particularly my observer. He must have wondered what sort of deck landing pilot I was going to be. But we did it. I mean, we did it. We spent a fortnight at HMS Triumph, which went into Antwerp. It was the biggest ship they'd ever had in Antwerp. And we had a jolly time around the shore. So it was, there was a good social side to it. So that was in 1952. I think probably, I don't know where we went in 1953, I can't remember. But 1954, we got up again at the crack of dawn on a Saturday morning with overload fuel tanks on, and we flew in formation to the south of France, down to an airfield called QAIRS, which was a naval air base, a French Navy air base, where we had lunch and plenty of wine. And bearing in mind that within 24 hours before, I'd been sitting in my office pushing a pen or whatever, this was a bit of a change of scene. Anyway, we took off after lunch and we went straight to Malta. And we landed back at Halfar, Malta, where I'd been in 45, and we spent a fortnight there.
What types of things were you doing there? Were you exercising with the Mediterranean fleet?
Well, we did. Yeah, there were some ships. I can't remember exactly, but basically we were doing the same thing there as we did back home. There was a rock that we used to chuck bombs on, and we did things with submarines and played about generally, but it was serious flying. I should always remember that I was senior pilot of 1842 squadron, and a chap called Roy Taylor was senior pilot of 1840 squadron, and we had a bet because we'd all gone out, the whole lot had gone out, not just one squadron, the two squadrons had gone out. Some had travelled out by civilian aircraft, you know, they didn't fly the anyway, doesn't matter. But Roy Taylor and I, we'd had a bet between us which of us would fly the most number of hours during this fortnight, because he was keen, but I didn't think he was as keen as I was. Anyway, we'd got to about the last day we were going to be there, and I'd sneaked a look, and I'd found out that he was marginally ahead of me. He'd got one or two trips more than I had. So without him knowing, I persuaded our chief petty officer, who was in charge of the maintenance, that one of our aircraft really needed test flying. It didn't really, but he saw the point. Oh yes, it needs a test, because we've just adjusted something or other. So I spent an hour and a half just flying this thing around. So I won the bet. He never forgave me.
But generally, you mentioned off the tape that you actually flew more intensively in
yes.
reserve than you had done in war.
Yeah, we did. I suppose when you look a bit, why did that happen? Because normally, of course, we were flying from shore bases, and you didn't have to wait for the ship to turn into the wind or for this, that and the other. So you could fly, not exactly when you wanted to, but I mean, provided the weather was not too desperate, you could fly, and you did fly. You did fly quite a lot, but certainly I did. And when I looked at my logbook, when I'd finished flying, it was considerably more hours spent in the reserve after the war than during my time in.
And I suppose it's a concentrated period of time, isn't it? Because that's what you are doing. You're there to fly.
Exactly. Oh yeah. Yes. This was the joy of it. You weren't expected to do ship's duties or anything else. I mean, basically, you left your civilian office, you turned up at Ford, and you were aircrew, and that was it. Provided you'd got the aircraft serviceable, you flew them. I say, being senior pilot, I mean, if I saw an aeroplane standing doing nothing, I flew it. Found some reason to fly it. It was brilliant.
Can you just outline to me the kind of role of what the senior pilot does within the squadron?
Well, basically, the senior pilot, the CO himself is overall in charge, of course. but the senior pilot has to make certain that his pilots, not the observers, the pilots are fully up to scratch in whatever, whether it's gunnery, bombing, or instrument flying. He has to make sure that they're all top line and make sure they're fully covered by all the requirements that you have to have to be allowed to fly. Talking about like instrument flying, for example, you have to have a check once a year and make sure that you can cope with any conditions. You had to make sure, well, obviously they had to be completely competent to fly the aircraft that we got, and to some extent, of course, we had a hand in preparing the flying program. In other words, if you were told that we had a task to do with six aircraft on a particular Saturday afternoon or whatever it was, you looked at the crews you got available and you allocated the crews to fly those missions depending on how much you wanted them to get that sort of experience.
So essentially you were really carrying out the practical side of operating the squadron, aren't you, in the sense that although the CO has a role command, you're the one who will say, well, we need this needs to be done, these
that's
people
right.
need
to yeah.
do that.
And your job is to check, A, what crews you've got available, what aircraft you've got available, what the task was, and then, if you were going to fly yourself on that particular mission, they weren't really missions because we weren't hitting anybody, but you then did the briefing. And this, of course, stood me in good stead for later life because I got so used to instructing for standing up and briefing people as to what they had to do, you know, which radio frequencies we used and all that sort of thing, what you did in an emergency or where you diverted and if things went wrong. We were all pretty clued up pilots by then, or air crew. We weren't just, you know, we weren't just, we'd all flown a lot.
And can you give me a little sort of insight to, I mean, you've given me obviously hints about the kind of ethos that was within that squadron.
Well,
how did everybody feel, you know?
We were all desperately proud because we were doing it as volunteers, and we did it because we wanted to do it. Okay, one or two mornings you wished you hadn't had to get out of bed, but I mean, it was something that we really wanted to do. The other interesting thing, Richard, which we should perhaps touch on, that the bulk of us were ex-wartime air crew, so we'd done it and we'd got that sort of wartime spirit about it. We didn't take too kindly to a lot of bull. If I can use that word, we didn't like that too much. We just wanted to do the job, but we also had with us some National Service air crew. After the war, people, the lads were doing their National Service. Not many, but a few people were trained as air crew. Sure, Enid will take it. Okay, yeah. Not many were allowed to be trained as aircrew because of their limited commitment to the National Service. But if they were trained as aircrew, then they had to commit themselves to flying in the reserve for, I used to know it, was it 3 years or 4 years? But was it four? Anyway, they had to commit themselves to that, so they came to us. Obviously probably 10, 12 years younger than we were, and they hadn't got the log books full of flying hours like we had, but they were keen chaps, and they learnt very quickly. Just slightly digressing here, there was one chap who was a particular buddy of mine, in fact flew as my wingman for a time, a chap called Brian Calvert, who worked in a bank in London in the week, but didn't much enjoy that. And he said to me one weekend, or when my wife and I were driving home with the baby in the back and he was in the back with the baby, he said, I don't think I like being in a bank. I think it was all triggered by the fact that he'd left the bank keys in his overalls down at Ford. And somebody had to take him back. Anyway, we're being a bit silly. But he gave up being in a bank and he said, I'm going to go for civil aviation. So he joined British Airways, or British Overseas Airways as it then was. And he flew VC-10s and eventually was one of the first people to be trained to fly Concorde, and became training captain of Concorde, and eventually took us all for a ride on Concorde. When I say all of us, a crowd of us from Ford, he took us up for a jolly round the bay. So, but he was a typical National Service pilot. I say 10 years younger than me, so he could do these things.
Were there any more overseas
We spent a fortnight in Eglinton in Northern Ireland. This would have been in 1956, I think, probably 55, 56. But again, just chasing submarines and generally, you know, doing the same sort of thing. But then, just we're getting towards the end of my naval flying now. What happened in 1955? Yes, it was 1955. A big rumour went round that we, when I say we, that was the Channel Air Division, our two squadrons, were going to re-equip with Fairey Gannets, which were very superior and top of the range naval aircraft. We were the only RNVR squadrons to get them. The others were still flying Fireflies or even Avengers and that sort of thing. So this duly happened, and all that I can remember is that we were three or four of us at a time spent two or three days up in Coventry with Armstrong Siddeley, who made the double Mamba engines that were in the Gannet, and we went there just to do engine handling. And I mean, I'd never flown a jet aircraft before. This was a turboprop, these aircraft. So we went up there in little groups of two or three, stayed in a posh hotel, and learned all about the double Mambas. And then, I think it was probably February 56, turned up at Ford one Saturday morning. I must have been on the... I'd arranged for my 2 weeks annual training. Turned up at Ford one Saturday morning, and there were two Fairey Gannets, the dual control ones, and two ordinary Gannets, and our little Fireflies, which were about half the size, sort of parked all around. There was a regular Navy instructor, a chap called Lieutenant Commander, forgotten the name now. Brain goes. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he was posted to us for a period of two or three months while we were all converted to fly these Gannets. It was wonderful, you know.
Tell me about the Gannet, because obviously it's a completely different aircraft, isn't it?
Completely different air. Well, it's a three-seater, you carried two observers. One was basically to deal with all the sonar buoy equipment and that sort of thing, and the other one was doing the normal navigating. I don't truthfully know what they did in the back, but you did carry two observers. It had this double Mamba engine, which were two engines side by side, but they drove a contra-rotating propeller on the front, with two sort of like crankcases or prop shafts, that's the word, one inside the other, if you can imagine that, one sort of hollow, which spun one engine one way one propeller one way and the other engine spun the other engine the other way. The idea being that you could get airborne using two engines, and when you were on patrol, on your anti-submarine patrol, you could shut one engine down and feather the propeller so that you were actually just flying around on one engine. This saved fuel. It meant you went a bit slower, of course, but it was a wonderful way of just conserving fuel, and meaning that you could stay on site on control on patrol for much longer. I can't remember the actual amount of time, but you could probably spend 3-4 hours or maybe more actually on patrol.
How did it handle for you as a pilot?
Well, I loved it because it was, to start off with, by then I was no longer a young man. The difficulty was climbing into it, which is, if you go to the museum, they've got one at Duxford, and you can see that it's like climbing up the side of a mountain to climb into these things. I don't think I could do it today, not with a walking stick as well. But anyway, no, but once you got into it, it was a lovely, comfortable sort of armchair sort of seat. You've got a wonderful view ahead. You've got a tricycle undercarriage. I'd never flown a tricycle undercarriage before, which is surprising after all these years. So it meant that you didn't have to keep the tail down when you were taxiing. You didn't have to zigzag to look ahead when you were taxiing, because you could just see straight over the nose. And it was a delight to fly, and it was relatively quiet. It was just a super aeroplane. We never got to take them to the deck, simply because there was no deck available, I think, by this time for us to play with. We practiced deck landings on the airfield using a mirror sight, where they had the batsman had gone by then and they had a mirror landing aid, so we learned all that. I'm quite convinced that had we had to go to sea in these things, we would have had no trouble at all. They were an absolute doddle in, would have been in my book. Just moving on, the RNVR squadrons disbanded in the beginning of 1957. The government cuts. The whole of the RNVR squadrons were just disbanded overnight. 11 squadrons, 23 Royal Auxiliary Air Force squadrons disbanded overnight, just like that. It was a vicious and savage sort of way of suddenly telling us that we were surplus to requirements and they didn't want us anymore. It came very hard. But where I was trying to get to was that the gunnets were extremely good anti-submarine aircraft, but to fly to protect a convoy or any fleet at sea, you needed an aircraft carrier, and a fairly big one, to get these things on and off. And at the same time, the government had decided that we weren't going to have any more aircraft carriers. So it was sad, because there were these wonderful aircraft which were suddenly going to be of no use in the anti-submarine role. That job was handed over to terrible things called helicopters, which, you know, was not quite playing cricket as far as we were concerned. Helicopters are not aeroplanes. In my book. So the gunnets were phased out from the anti-submarine role. Obviously not just the RNVR, the regular Navy lost them in that role. They did reconvert them to serve as airborne early warning aircraft with a huge radome underneath. Ugly great beasts. I mean, I would have almost been ashamed to stand next to one. But they did a very good job in the anti-submarine airborne early warning role, and that was their major role right the way through to the late 1970s.
One other thing with the Gannett that I've heard before was sometimes there were problems starting it. Is that right? Or is that something?
Don't think so. No, I mean I'm trying to remember how we started it. I mean, you had a you could start either engine first. It didn't matter, but I forget which one we did normally do. But you had a cartridge, quite a big cartridge, like a small shell that was loaded in, and you fired this thing, which spun the propeller round, and when it got to a certain number of revs, you sort of more or less lit a match and threw it onto the well, the fuel was turned on and you put the ignition on and the jet started, you see. So when you got one engine running perfectly happily on its jet, then you unfeathered the other air screw, which spun automatically then, because it was in the draft of the other one, and that just spun round and you lit that one, and it was great. I don't think we ever had any great trouble starting them.
You also mentioned using the mirror sight.
Mirror landing aid, yeah.
How does that work, John?
I'm not a technical person. Well, it was a great big mirror that stood on an aircraft carrier's deck where the batsman used to stand. And it was a concave, I hope I'm right, concave mirror. And it had got a line of lights shining onto it from wherever. There was a light source that shone a beam of lights horizontally across this mirror, and another one that I think went vertically. And you, as a pilot, had to keep... There was a ball that moved depending on where the aircraft was. And it's called flying the meatball. This is what the Yanks decided it was should be called, flying the meatball. And by moving your aircraft in relation to this mirror, you actually lined up this meatball dead in the centre where these two lines intersect. And if you kept it there, you were going to eventually collide with the deck just where you wanted to. It was all gyroscopically controlled, so that as the ship moved and rolled and pitched, this was all taken care of. So as a pilot, all you had to do was just get this thing lined up and just fly it, you'd eventually hit the deck and catch a wire, hopefully. As I say, we never actually did it on a deck. But it had to come, because aircraft were getting bigger and heavier and faster. I mean, the days of the batsman, where you could see, were over. And then, of course, the other thing that happened, again, we never used it, was the angled deck, which were, I think we ought to a big plug here. The angled deck and the mirror landing sight and the hydraulic capital were all British inventions. But if you talk to our dear friends across the Atlantic, they probably wouldn't accept that.